Welcome. It's ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host, Ryan White. Normally with us is my business partner, David McKelvin. He's out dealing with his house somewhere up in San Marcos, seemingly pretty close to the ongoing fires. So our thoughts are certainly with him, as well as everybody that was displaced. Remember, you mentioned you were kind of close to it, right, Karen?
Yes. In fact, when I left to come here this morning, I saw the hill that is not more than 500 feet from my house, a little smoldering. So I'm a little worried about that, but the show must go on.
Well, our thoughts are certainly with all those that were displaced because of the fires. I certainly hope that works out. With us today, as you heard, I have Karen Cassino with a whole lot of letters behind her name, CPA, CVA, CFE, MFFA. We'll find out what those are a little later in the show. She is with the Cassino CPA firm, and her website, fraudsafecpa.com. Karen, welcome.
Thank you.
Also, Marilyn Beerer with Beer & Associates Family Law, her website, beererlaw.com. That is her website. She is a family law attorney. Marilyn, welcome.
Thank you.
So as you might have guessed, with a CPA and an attorney in the room, we're going to talk about finances and divorce. And, well, frankly, there's a lot of interweaving of the two, especially with the specific set of skills that Karen uses to identify money, find money, trace money. And that's kind of what is ahead of us. We're going to talk about the top 10 most important financial decisions to make before or during a divorce. So again, the top 10 most important financial decisions to make before or during a divorce. And so we're talking about divorce, but in order for someone to be divorced, they got to get married, right? And you have on your list, what should you think about before you get married? And I would imagine many people blow right past all of, you talked about community property and prenups and all this stuff. Just, they don't even think about, have any idea they're in love. They want a wedding. Maybe she wants a wedding, he wants an open bar, and here they're off running, right?
Big party.
Big party, that's right. So to either one of you, what is it I should think about, I guess, from a financial or divorce perspective prior to getting married?
Well, I'll start with the financial end. Okay. And that is, even if you're 22, 25, 30, 40, 50, especially people that are older and have assets that they've already accumulated prior to the time that they're going to get married, you really do need to think about what both of you already own. And then what are you going to do when you get married? A younger couple with no children, that's a little easier because they're going to get married. They're probably going to do what we call commingle everything and operate as one family unit. But if you're getting married later in life and each of you or one of you has your own set of children, well, there's going to be probably different financial rules that you may want to establish before you get married. And whether you actually have a formal prenup or you just sit down and say, this is how we're going to do things. For instance, when one party's kids go to college, who's going to pay for that? Is that going to come out of one person's money? Are we going to combine everything? There's a lot of things that come up that it's good to talk about before you get married and discuss it. And again, whether it's a formal prenup, Marilyn, or just an agreement.
First of all, the presumption in family law that once you get married, everything is community. And if you're older and you have children that you want to send to college, I believe that the most prudent thing to do is put it in a prenup or put it in some sort of a writing. A prenuptial agreement is nothing more than a contract. And it's a contract that generally says, okay, we're living in California, but we're not going to follow your community property rules. And you lay out the rules or what you want to be the guidelines for your marriage. Prenups are important, especially as Karen was saying. If you're older and you each come to this marriage with substantial assets, let's say I have a house and I'm still working and my husband is still working, but you're living in my house and I'm paying the mortgage. Without a prenup, he gets even if I don't put them on title, what's called a Moore Marsden interest in my property. And people don't realize that. It's a smaller interest than an equitable interest. It's generally a certain percentage of the pay down of the loan. But you need to know these things. I think that everybody in California, maybe the United States, when you're getting married, be prudent. Go visit a divorce lawyer, someone who knows a community property, and get an education.
So let's talk about that. You've mentioned the word community a couple times. Mm-hmm. What does that mean in the context of assets and real estate? How is it working?
Okay. On the date of marriage, when you get married, everything you have remains your separate property unless it is what's called transmuted by an agreement. After that, if there's no prenup, everything you own, every dollar, is presumed to be community property. 50 cents of my dollar is yours, 50 cents of my dollar is mine, and anything we buy with that, you get an interest in it. That's the community. The community starts generally on the date of marriage, and the community ends by death or on a date of separation.
Okay, so the assumption is made without a prenup that everything is the what you make during, no matter who makes it, what the husband or wife, or I guess you'd be partner now, right. That is what I should say, the partners make during the time of marriage is, again, community property and will be split 50-50?
Well, that's a presumption.
That's the presumption with community property.
Which is a rebuttable presumption. And if it's yours, you have to show you had it beforehand. But if you're commingling your assets in one bank account, and my paycheck goes in and your paycheck goes in, how do we know which dollar paid the mortgage?
To the same account, of course. Right. Got it. So it makes it muddies the waters, so to speak, if you attempt to sever this relationship. And I would imagine it is those muddy waters is a lot of the reason that a CPA needs to be involved.
Exactly. One good thing that people should keep in mind before they get married is keep separate accounts. If you have separate money going into a marriage, a separate property, a piece of real estate, keep that separate. Open a separate bank account with just your name on it, where the money for that property or your earnings from your separate property or that bank account that you own prior to marriage, it stays completely separate. It never gets mixed. We call it mixed in with community money. That makes it a lot easier for me when you get separated and I come in and I try and figure out what is separate and what's community belonging to both of you. That's just a good rule to follow, is if you've got separate property, keep it separate and keep separate bank accounts, keep separate records.
So you mentioned commingled, and that being the mixing of the combined earnings, I suspect, and mixing assets, so to speak, and the difficulty of unmixing them after they're mixed together. But having dual bank accounts, is that something that, so let's say one spouse doesn't work and the other one does, is that person on a draw? Or how is it that, no. that how do you advise that working out?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm glad you brought it up, because there's a common misperception there with working spouses that if they're the ones working, then it's their money. And as Marilyn said a little bit earlier, anything you earn while you're married is community. So if I'm out there working and my husband is sitting at home watching ESPN and watching sports all the time, still everything I earn, he gets half of. Period. That's the way community property works. Now, if you do a prenup, as Marilyn mentioned earlier, you could say, you know, you can pretty much put in a prenup whatever the two of you agree to and get someone to write up. So, but if you don't have a prenup, then half of what the other person makes is yours while you're married.
But there are some strict rules when you write a prenup. You have to have, each party must have or should have their own lawyer. It should not be presented to the other party on the eve of a marriage, because then there's a presumption of undue influence. So you have to know all those rules. If you're getting married and you have a marriage 6 months out, you go 7 months out to a lawyer and draft the prenup. And get it done and signed, and each party must have their own lawyer. This way, there's no presumption of undue influence, and it would be much harder to set it aside.
Now, you mentioned more Marsden interest as a way of gaining interest by simply living in a home. Tell me more about that.
A more Marsden interest is when you take a community dollar, okay, and you pay on a separate property asset.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so the house is mine before marriage, mm-hmm. and I'm paying the mortgage on it. I have no prenup. I'm working. My husband's home's eating bonbons, and I'm paying the mortgage out of the money I earn. And then we're getting a divorce, and I'm thinking, well, it's my house. Not so much. And so I'm not going to go through the formula because it's a very in-depth, convoluted formula. But that your spouse does get a small percentage of the pay down of the principal mortgage during the marriage. That's what you end up with.
That does
pro rata or pro tanto share.
That does sound complicated. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Marilyn Bierer. Her website, biererlaw.com. That's spelled B-I-E-R-R-E-R, law.com. One more time, B-I-E-R-E-R-law.com. Go see her. Should you be thinking about getting married at some point? Should you fall in love? First stop should be with the family law attorney, biererlaw.com. When we come back, going to talk more with Karen Cassino about what we might need to know prior to filing a divorce. Ahead of us when we come back. Welcome back. We've been talking with Marilyn Bierer. Her website is biererlaw.com. That's her website, biererlaw.com. Move over here to Karen Cassino. She is a CPA, CVA, CFE, and MFFA. Why don't you walk us through what that means? I think we got the CPA part down. What's a CVA?
CVA is a certified valuation analyst, so I do business appraisals.
I see. And a CFE?
Certified fraud examiner.
And an MFFA?
That's a master's in financial forensics.
Wow, that is a lot of numbers.
Yeah.
A lot of time in Excel?
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of time with Excel. Got it.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, we're talking about the top 10 most important financial decisions to make before a divorce. And what do people need to do with their finances, get in line with their finances prior to dropping this bomb? I mean, I assume it's going to be a bomb they're going to drop on their partner about the disillusion of this business they've created, such as a marriage. What should one do?
That's a good question. And these pointers are good for really anybody to know and to do, because if their spouse dies, for instance, suddenly, it's the same thing. And the pointers are: know your finances, know what you make, know where your bank accounts are, know if you have investment accounts, know what assets you have. It's surprising how many people come to myself, and I know Marilyn, that don't have any idea where they get their money from, where their money is sitting.
Really?
I know, it's surprising.
Sounds wonderful. So I don't have to worry about all that.
There's a number of people that will sign tax returns on a yearly basis that never look at them. And now with the e-filing of tax returns, it's pretty easy for your spouse to not even have you sign the tax return. So my pointers are, get your hands on your tax returns and have those. If you think that there's a situation where there might be violence or something might happen once you serve the person with papers, and you know, they may not give you documents, it's a good thing just have your tax returns where you know where they are. Make copies. Get them over to Marilyn or myself so we have them in our office. Bank statements, credit card statements. Loan applications, those are great because those list all your assets and your liabilities. Now, whether they're accurate or not is another question, but at least it's a place to start. But the tax returns are the Bible, and so are bank statements. Anything that they can get their hands on, make copies of, keep somewhere or give it to their attorney or their forensic so that you have those. Once you send them papers and the divorce starts, you're legally entitled to those documents, but it's surprising how many times we actually fight over getting those documents in a divorce. So if you have them available, then that makes our job a lot easier. It makes your life a lot easier. The other thing, too, is make sure you have some access to funds, because you're going to need to hire your attorney. You're going to need to hire your forensic. You're going to need to live maybe 2 or 3 months without money. Usually the way it works, just to make it real simple, is you'll file. Within a couple months, you're going to be in front of the court getting preliminary spousal support, child support orders, if it's not done voluntarily. It can take 60, 90 days sometimes. So make sure you have 60 to 90 days worth of money somewhere that you can live on in case things go completely crazy. Make sure your name is on the credit card accounts. You may have a credit card with your name on it, but that may be your husband's credit card, and he can go in the next day and cancel it, and then you have no ability to, you know, charge your fees for your attorney, etc. You just need some money that you can get your hands on.
We're talking with Karen Cassino. Her website, Fraud Safe CPA. That's her website, fraudsafecpa.com, about the top 10 most important financial decisions to make before or during a divorce. Went a little bit in line with your documentation and getting it in a row, and you had mentioned that you might have to fight for documents. What do you mean you have to fight for them? I mean, can't I go on and download whatever I need in terms of bank statements? Is that no longer applicable? I guess maybe it's not.
Well, a lot of times what happens is there's just one party on the bank account. You may think that, well, it's a joint bank account. I put my money in there. Maybe my husband's name is the only name on that bank account for some odd reason. The other thing that happens is husband or wife has their own business, and they pay for a lot of stuff out of their business. And the what we call the outspouse, the in-spouse is a person that owns and operates a business. The outspouse, while their expenses may be paid out of that business, they have no access to get statements or to get funds out of that bank account.
I see. So getting your name on stuff seems pretty important.
Yes, getting names on the bank accounts, getting names on the credit card accounts, making sure that you have an ability to get money to live on for a few months and to hire your attorney and make sure you're taken care of.
Now, you can't hide that money from the court. There's, on the back of the summons, there is something called automatic temporary restraining orders, or ATROs, as we call them. And once you file your petition for a dissolution, technically everything is to stay frozen in time. Very often what will happen is one spouse or the other will need the money, will go to the bank, take out $50,000, hypothetically, and then they put it in an account in their name. Now they're separated, so there's a presumption it's his or her separate property. But you need to tell the court, this is what I've done. It's no hiding the ball, because the court will get very angry if you take that kind of money, hide it, and don't own up to it. Because the court understands you need money to live on, and that when everything comes down to the bottom line numbers of who's getting what, when, and where, you're going to be deemed as having received as a pre-dissolution, asset.
Distribution.
A pre-distribution of community assets. And so if, let's say, if you're getting $1,000, they're going to take that say you're getting $100,000, they're going to take that $50,000 off the $100,000, and you'll only get $50,000. Does that make sense?
Certainly does. We're talking with Marilyn Bierer, her website, BiererLaw.com. Now, I would imagine you've got plenty of stories where by the time the client makes it to your office, you said, boy, I wish you would have done blah before you came in here, or I wish you would have talked to me before you did blah. Right. So it almost sounds like there is a certain amount of divorce planning that one might. Do you see many people prior to them ready to drop this ball?
Well, how my office does it, they come in for interview because I'm an acquired personality.
Okay. Is that a term of art?
Yeah. Okay.
And so they have to know they like me. They have to be able to work with me. And so they sit down and we go through their assets and we go through what the divorcing process is. I give them a lot of paper to read. And so at that point, they should go home, think about it, and come back and then hire me if they want me to represent them. And you can go through it with them. My staff can go through it with them. But I'm going to tell them before they tell their spouse to go home and make copies of everything they can get their hands on. Because those papers are going to disappear. They just are.
They always do.
if it's most divorces are contention, contentious. However, there are some that aren't, and they go into mediation, and that's a whole different mindset. And if you can mediate, that's great.
And why do they disappear?
Because one spouse doesn't want the other spouse to know exactly what they have. And so when they said spousal support or child support, there's no record of the actual earnings, especially if you're self-employed.
So bank statements and stuff like that can't be produced. But you mentioned with a subpoena there, yes. It seems like just a whole lot of extra time, effort, and money
That's
to go
correct.
Into something they're going to get anyway. I mean, it seems crazy to fight that.
That's correct. It does seem crazy to fight it,
okay.
But they do. I mean, there's even a code section that says you have to disclose everything. Without it, this is very brief definition of it, but without it, you've breached your fiduciary duty. Husbands and wives have fiduciary duties to treat each other as business partners. And so if I have a business and I'm not disclosing the documents to my husband and his attorney, that's a breach of fiduciary duty if they catch me at it.
We're talking with Marilyn Bierer, her website, beererlaw.com. That's the website, beererlaw.com. I can kind of wrap my mind around how, certainly not the moral thing to do, but I can wrap my mind around how it might make sense to lose the bank statement from some offshore bank account, but my Wells Fargo right down the street and my Citibank, you know, two blocks away, it just doesn't seem like there's any benefit to be had by not coughing those up.
It's not necessarily the personal accounts, as Karen was saying. This is more prevalent with people where there's a family business.
Makes sense.
And you can't get those accounts. I have to send a subpoena. I mean, I had to go get some records from the VA. I had to go to court to have the judge sign it because it's a federal entity. So it becomes rather difficult.
I think a good thing for people to know is that you are pretty much obligated to provide those documents.
Yes.
And the other side is probably going to get their hands on those. It's just going to be more time consuming and more expensive, and you're going to end up paying for that in terms of legal fees. And the other thing, too, is you asked why someone would do that. Oddly, I think it's odd, and we'll see if Marilyn thinks it's odd, too. People use the process, the divorce process, to punish the other person. I'm not going to give her the statements. I'm not going to give her this. I'm not going to give her that. Or it could be the opposite, too. And I know myself, and I know Marilyn, too, but most attorneys I work with, we encourage our clients, don't punish the other person through the process. Don't use this process to make a point, because it doesn't make a point. It just costs more money. You know, try and work out the psychological issues with a psychologist on the side and deal right up front with the financial issues. And the other thing that we like to, I know I do, just tell the truth and be honest. It's a lot cheaper, a lot quicker, and you look a lot better in front of the court. If I have a client that wants to play games, then they aren't my client.
We're talking with Karen Cassino. Her website is fraudsafecpa.com. That's her website, fraudsafecpa.com. When we come back, we're going to talk about how to keep your fees down when going through the process. You talked about using the process to punish them, and I would imagine punishing them means stretching the process out, certainly. So it would be the opposite of keeping the fees down. We'll talk about that when we come back. Welcome back. We have with us here Marilyn Bierer. She is a family law attorney with Bierer & Associates Family Law. Her website, beererlaw.com. That's B-I-E-R-E-R law.com. Also with us, Karen Cassino, the Cassino CPA firm. Her website, fraudsafecpa.com. That's the website, fraudsafecpa.com. So I would imagine when going through a divorce, fighting over the money, in addition to custody, are one of the major things people are fighting about. So if I'm going to spend all of that money I'm fighting over, paying to fight over it, doesn't make a whole lot of sense, right? So what is it I should be doing to reduce the expense of going through a divorce and thus leaving more money for my wife, my husband, whether I hate them or not, leave more money for them, my children, whatever else I want to do with it, instead of eating it up in the process? I'm sure you've got multiple suggestions.
Well, the first thing you do is you don't play games with each other. You each get a respective attorney and you sit down and you start from the onset. Okay, here's the assets, here's the income, this is what we're going to do, this is how it works, and you start going through each issue. When clients come to see me, they come to meet me before they retain me, I hand them a packet of all kinds of things, what dissolution is about. And one of the things I give them is a document called Suggestions for Reducing Fees.
You actually give them a document that tells them how to pay you less?
Yes.
Wow.
I do.
Do they read that?
I hope so. I send them home. It's very simple things can save them money. For example, don't call me for every little thing he or she says. You need to get it off your chest. You really want me to know about it? Call my staff. Call the cheapest person on the list, and that generally would be my gal who works in the office, who does my copying and things. She'll get me the message. I pride myself on the fact of calling clients back with pretty much within 24 hours. And if you're lucky, I call you while I'm in the car and you don't get billed for it.
Car time is free, huh?
Car time is free. So that's the one thing you do. And you have to remember that if you're going to call me and want to talk to me, I turn on the clock and you're getting billed for every 12 minutes. And it goes up. You know, it's not like if you're on the phone with me 11 minutes, you're still going to get billed for 12 minutes. So that's, you know, that's how it works.
Well, I'm really interested in the fact that you provide people homework as kind of a cooling off period, so to speak, after your intake package, after your first meeting. Mm-hmm. And one of their homework assignments is go kind of get this together so you don't end up paying everything through the process.
Right.
That seems really refreshing to me that you've got a whole list and actually two pages. You're holding it there. A two-page document, big font, little font on the prop, describing all the things that one can do to not spend enormous amount of money through the process. Go through a few more.
Well, one of the big things that is my personal pet peeve is that my staff, we send every piece of paper, a copy, to the client. If I get a letter from opposing counsel, documents come back from court, things that we have drafted, they get a copy of everything. And people don't keep it organized. And one of the things they should do right from the onset, they should get these little binders for correspondence from their lawyer, correspondence from the other side's lawyer, pleadings from their side, pleadings from the other side, so that they can constantly keep up with and look at what's going on in their case. To get a document from me and throw it into a bag, which is very often when they come back, they've got this bag of documents, and then they're going to pay for my staff to put it in a binder. So don't do that. It's simple. You know, you take a look at the date. All you got to do is put it in chronological order, and you'll have it. And then when you come in and you want to talk to me about it, everything is filed by a date in mind, and we can go right to it.
We're talking with Marilyn Bierer, going through a few things you can do to keep your divorce fees down. Her website is biererlaw.com. That's her website, biererlaw.com.
I think the biggest thing you said, Marilyn, was that people should not play games.
Yeah.
Disclose what you have and produce documents and cooperate. Unfortunately, you can make headway by being difficult. I won't say that you can't. And I don't advise them to do that, nor does Marilyn. I know that. But that is the biggest driver of expense, is if you aren't going to disclose and you aren't going to provide documents, and Marilyn has to write a letter, she's got to go to court, they've got to ask for documents, the court has to tell you to produce the documents that we all know we're entitled to, that's where it gets expensive. The other thing, too, is it's good to get an idea of what you're going to have to pay, what it really looks like, and whether that's before you, right before you get divorced or at the beginning, you sit down usually with someone like me, a forensic accountant, and your attorney, and we look at everything that you have, and you're being completely honest with us, and we look through it and say, you know what, this is what it looks like. You would end up with about this, she would end up with about that. Support might be in a range of a certain amount of dollars so that they know. And here's the kicker. If somebody sits there and hears that and says, that's not okay with me, that's just not, you know, I'm going to fight this. I'm going to just fight till the bitter end. And, you know, and then we have decisions to make because probably Marilyn will, but say to them, well, you know, it is community property and it's 50-50 unless you've got separate property and this is what might likely happen. Well, but I want to punish him or her and I don't want to pay that and I want to do everything I can so she doesn't or he doesn't end up with the money that they're entitled to. That's going to be expensive. That's going to be very expensive if you're going to be that difficult, and you probably won't get a lot of family law attorneys and forensics that will work with you if you're going to do that. But believe me, I've seen it a number of times, a number of times. Yeah. I've had clients tell me, I want her to be homeless and penniless living in the streets. And we explain to him or her that that probably isn't going to what's going to happen. But if they're going to head down this road of punishing through the process, then it's going to be expensive. And here's the problem is if you're the wife and you want to, and I have my hands in the air, make the person, your husband, pay, then you are going to incur a ton of legal fees that you don't need to incur. He will incur a lot of legal fees he doesn't need to incur. And what will happen at the end of the case, Marilyn?
Well, very often there's something, you know, the court may sanction you and you're not going to get what you think you're entitled to. They're going to say, listen, as a result of your behavior, this and this and this and this and this had to happen. And so we're going to make him a little bit whole. And so I taught community property. One of the things I said was you have to get to a place in your head that it's okay to do this. And someone's going to leave a dime on the table. If not, you see this pen? How much do you want to pay for it? And I'm holding up probably a 25-cent pen. You end up with much, much less. And then you're sitting there going, what happened? And who do they blame? Hello, I'm the first person they're going to blame. You didn't tell me. Well, that's not true because I usually put it in writing. But it's not fun. It's not fun. And one more thing, if it's a true breach of fiduciary duty and you're not, and you've breached it, the code says the other spouse can end up with all of it and you end up with nothing. And it's a very famous case called Rossi, R-O-S-S-I. And Mrs. Rossi knew she was going to file for divorce. And then she went and she bought a lottery ticket. And she took the money from his wallet to buy the ticket. Community. Dollar ticket. She won. Millions. And she didn't tell him. They went through the divorce, and then he found out because the state of California contacted him. The judge took the money from her and gave it to her husband.
100%.
100%.
Not 50%.
So damages, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it's not worth it.
And you could end up paying for legal fees of not only yourself but the other side. It doesn't happen as often maybe as it should, but it is a possibility too. So that's just something for your audience to think about is, you know, try to tell the truth. Try and be forthcoming. Try to be helpful. If you're going to go down the road where you're not going to be helpful and you're trying to make the other person pay and you're making attorney's fees be expensive, you could end up paying for both yours and theirs.
So with the understanding that the more we fight and the more punitive you want to be with the process, that fees go up, and presumably you explain this to your clients commonly. You have massive amounts of disclosures about it in two-page form about it. What percentage of the time do they take heed of that process and change their mind and say, hey, I'm not going to make this punitive. I'm going to do it efficiently. We're not going to fight over every little thing. let's do what the attorney and CPA says. How often does that work?
I take the fifth.
Pre-recession or post-recession? It certainly has changed the last few years.
Once I sit down with them and once they get several months of billing, they tend to listen to me more than not listen to me.
So they got
to
be really – so you got to tell them where they can hear it in their ears and then tell them again where they can feel it in their pocketbook in order for them to really take heed of what's going on. And so when they understand it's going to cost them a couple thousand dollars to argue about 50 cents, why bother? Well, that's great advice. Here we're talking with Marilyn Bierer, her website, beererlaw.com. When we come back, we're going to talk about forensic accounting and how that can help with Karen Cassino ahead of us when we come back. Welcome back. We've been talking with Marilyn Bierer about how to keep your divorce fees down. Her website, beererlaw.com, and that's spelled B-I-E-R-E-R-Law.com, B-I-E-R-E-R-Law.com. Now, as an adjunct to that, should you decide that you don't want to keep your fees down and you decide you want to hide stuff, there may be need for a forensic accountant. Now, I think we've all kind of heard of that idea, but what does that really mean?
So a forensic accountant is someone that has specialized training. They're an accountant, but they have specialized training in usually some sort of fraud investigations. They've taken classes in tracing money and litigation, and a lot of us are business appraisers also, so there's skills of business appraisal as well as tracking money and specifically knowing what to do in various types of cases. What we're talking about today in terms of family law, it's a very, very tricky area in terms of the laws and the way that things are done procedurally with the courts. So finding a CPA that has experience in the family courts is really, really, really important because there's things that matter and things that don't. I mean, we've already talked about a lot of it in this hour is, you know, the presumption of community property and what things need to happen and more Marsden calculations. And these are things that an average CPA probably is not going to know about. You do want someone with some specialized skill that has the database of materials and the research and all of the things that we've got available to us that we can meet with you and figure out. One of the things I do well is sitting down with people, hearing their story and figuring out what we can actually pursue and what sounds like it's the areas we should, you know, the avenues we should go down, because a lot of times we get people, for instance, that come in, a lot of times it's a wife, it's not always a wife, but the wife saying, you know, I've been married to this man for 15 years. I don't have any idea how we make money. I know that we've got properties and businesses and he goes to work every day. I know he works for a company, but they call it something else. And I really don't, I've been raising the kids for 15 years. I don't really know for sure what's going on. So that's where someone like me is really good from the start, because I can help, one, have her grab the documentation that she needs to get. Again, there's nothing, I said grab, I didn't mean grab, because it should be stuff she's entitled to anyway. And really from the start of the case, figuring out what it is that's there, what she might be entitled to, and then actually sitting down with her or him if it's a he, and figuring out what will this property settlement look like and how are you going to live your life. We get a lot of people that have substantial wealth and a lot of assets, and if it's the wife who's never run any of this stuff before, you know, what are our options when we get divorced? He can pay her for 50% of the worth of those assets. She could take what we call in kind, which means she takes, you know, some properties or maybe the interest, the 50% of the interest in all of these entities. And so now all of a sudden, someone that was raising kids is now half partner in all these businesses. By the way, the court doesn't usually like to do that. But there's a lot of different possibilities. And so not only a forensic accountant will be helping to look for hidden things, but we're also going to work with the people just understanding complex financial estates and understanding what it is, how they make their money, and hopefully helping people come up with a resolution between them that makes sense to them. Because here's the thing. We go to court, and the court can only do certain things. The court can divide stuff in half. They can order stuff to be sold. But what we can do if we settle with each other is a lot more creative. You know, we can do things like, you know, let her live in the house for 5 years until the kids are grown. And then at that point, they put the house on the market. There's a lot of things that cooperatively we can talk about and put into an agreement that makes sense for both parties. And that's where someone like me is really helpful, because I can be assessing the financial aspects of different settlement proposals and what makes sense to one party and what makes sense to the other party, because it doesn't have to be an adversarial process.
We're talking with Karen Cassino. Her website is fraudsafecpa.com. That's the website, fraudsafecpa.com. So it kind of sounds like, I mean, dividing up the bank accounts, relatively easy. I mean, that doesn't sound so complicated. But businesses and other assets that are more difficult to divide up, sounds like you're able to assign a value to it so people get some understanding of what they're arguing about. If we're going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars fighting for a business, certainly would be nice to know what kind of value that business has. And it sounds like that's a lot of what you do.
Yes, I can appraise the businesses. Real estate, like what you do, there's real estate appraisers that do that specifically for litigation. Usually there are specific people that do that. So,
how often do you find that after appraising a business, you determine it's not worth fighting for?
Well, one party is probably going to get that business. So one, you know, either they ran it together or one party ran it and the other person didn't, wasn't a part of it. Somebody's going to get that business, or sometimes they can put it up and sell it. They can put it on the market and sell it. That's pretty uncommon. So a value needs to be put on it, because it needs to be put on, as we call it, on one person's side of the ledger or not. So, you know, you need to come up with a value. Now, it could be that it's worth no more than their balance sheet, their net equity on the balance sheet. It could be that. It could be worth zero. A lot of times we hear that a lot. You know, people, I love the person that comes in and says, I have been losing money in this business for 10 years and, you know, it's worth nothing. I make no money. And we always look at them and go, you've been running a business that you've been making zero money at for the last 10 years. One, I don't believe that. But two, what a judge will do is look at them and say, then you better go get a job. Because you got a family to support. You have a duty to support your family, your kids, your ex-wife, your ex-husband. You don't get to go into the court and say, oh, I have a business that makes nothing. That doesn't fly. And I don't believe it. I don't believe that you continue with a business for 10 years that makes no money.
Well, I can see someone that perhaps the partner that started the business to have some amount of emotional attachment to it and perhaps not want to fail and assign an unnecessarily inappropriate number to that business that perhaps they're fighting for, and when it really comes down to it, it's actually worth quite a bit more or quite a bit less than reality. I can see it happening a lot.
Just remember that most of the time with business appraisals, the generator of value is going to be the income that that business is generating. It's not
Makes
always
sense.
True, because there are some capital-intensive businesses that are worth a lot because they're capital-intensive. But you're looking at a business, if it's generating some income, it's probably most likely going to have value. So it's pretty much income-driven. Now, we get a ton of people, and this is probably a whole nother day on your show, would be talking about the things we see in terms of what people do to hide income. They don't report all their cash. They pay for all their living expenses through their company. Those are things that I get hired to look at and try and figure out.
We're talking with Karen Cassino, the Cassino CPA firm, fraudsafecpa.com. That's their website, fraudsafecpa.com. We only have a minute or so left, but let's talk about some alternatives to fighting it out in court.
Mediation. Go find a mediator. Don't go to a litigator.
Oh. You know, so certain attorneys specialize in mediation?
Yes,
is that what you're saying?
They do.
Okay.
And you go together. Generally, a good mediator, and there are several that I recommend if someone wants to do that, will not speak to either party without the presence of the other party. So you call their office, you tell them you want mediation, and then both of you go in there and you try to resolve everything. It only works if both people want it to.
Sure, I can see that.
If one person doesn't want it to work and wants to continue the harangue, it's never going to, it can't work. So that's some of the things you need to think about. Am I the person that's not letting this settle? Why am I doing this? And that's Karen says, go see a psychiatrist or a psychologist and figure it out.
What percentage of divorces would you say are capable of not going through the arduous litigation process?
I really don't know because I litigate. I'm a litigator. but I would say 25%, Karen.
25% go to court.
Yeah. No, mediation.
Mediation. Okay, yeah. So three quarters are contentious in some fashion.
Well, they start out mediating and end up in court.
End up in court.
The other thing, too, the other statistic that is kind of known is that 80% of cases will settle before they go to trial.
Oh, that's so wonderful.
So they may
threat.
Go into litigation, but they're going to settle eventually before trial.
Wonderful. Yeah. We've been talking with Marilyn Bierer. One more time, her website, BiererLaw.com, and Karen Cassino, FraudSafeCPA.com. Ladies, I want to thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Everybody out there, we'll talk to you next week.